welcome to That Makes Total Sense, the podcast where we talk about faith, finance, and everyday life in a way that makes total sense. I'm your host, Alexis Busetti. On this podcast, you'll hear the personal stories of friends I'll be interviewing who are doing familiar things in new and innovative ways. We'll answer questions specifically about money and our relationship with it, and we'll explore faith and Bible teaching together. In all of these, it's not about changing our convictions as much as it is about messing with our methods. We'll have a lot of moments here together where we pause, then say, that makes total sense. Hi, this is Alexis Busetti, and I'm so glad you've joined me today for the podcast. Last week, I had the incredible privilege of speaking with Jean Bishop. Jean is an attorney and an advocate, and she's also an author who has written two captivating books. Today, as I record this introduction, is actually April 19th, 2020, which is the 25th anniversary of the bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma City, the Murrell Building, that took place on April 19th, 1995. The reason I mention that is because Jean's most recent book is called Grace from the Rubble, and she tells the story of the father of the bomber, Bill McVeigh, and Bud Welch, who was the father of one of the victims of the bombing, and their forgiveness, reconciliation, and relationship to come from that. This is an incredible book. I read it in 2 days, but it also made me want to read her first book, which is her story called Change of Heart, when she had to walk through those same steps of forgiveness after her sister and her sister's husband and their unborn child were murdered in Chicago. So I loved my conversation with Jean. I know you will too. I'll have links to her books and her bio in the notes for this episode. So enjoy this conversation I had with Jean Bishop. Hi, everybody. I am Alexis Busetti, and I want to welcome you again to That Makes Total Sense. I was just telling our guest that I am still feeling a little awestruck, a little stunned, because I just finished this author's first book, her memoir, and I am stunned. I'm still kind of getting over it, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. But I have Jean Bishop today, who wrote the book we're going to talk about today, which is called Grace from the Rubble. Hi, Jean. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I've already said just a little bit, you're an author, but you have a career and a life story that is so much more vast than that. So can you give us some context for the kind of work that you do and where you live and what your family looks like now?
Sure. So I was born on the North Shore of Chicago, where I live now, but I did a kind of a loop. I grew up in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, and moved back here when I started journalism school at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism. And from there, I went to Northwestern Law School and then transferred to Yale Law School. And then I became first a corporate lawyer. And then when my younger sister, Nancy, was murdered at the age of 25, along with her husband, that was just this huge wake-up call that life is short and we can't waste it on anything as shallow as what, you know, I was doing, which is doing a corporate law job that I didn't really love or deeply believe in or give my best self to. So I left and became a public defender, which is a job I've been doing since she was murdered decades ago. It's a job that I love. It's a very demanding job right now as the coronavirus spreads through the Cook County Jail here. And I spent my day, you know, trying to get people out of that jail. But I also write. I've written a lot of short form things, book chapters, things for CNN.com and Huffington Post, places like that. But my first book was about the murder in my family and my forgiveness and reconciliation with her killer. This second book that I've written, Grace from the Rubble, just was released yesterday as we record this. And I'm so excited. It's also a story of forgiveness and mercy and reconciliation about my friend Bud Welch from Oklahoma City, who lost his daughter in the bombing, and this extraordinary friendship with the father of the bomber.
This is an incredible story. So I love how God just puts things together. And I am an avid reader, and I woke up this morning telling my husband, books are my love language. I think I've just figured it out. And I happen to be in the right place at the right time when Zondervan was doing a giveaway of a number of titles. And they were saying, you know, because books are going to be in short supply right now as far as shipping, and we can't get to libraries and things like that. And they just decided, you know, out of the goodness of their heart, to go ahead and just throw out several titles, you know, one of each title. And so I was like, I'll play that game. And so I ended up winning this copy of Grace from the Rubble. I didn't realize that it was technically an advanced copy at the time, because I received it just barely before it came out yesterday. And I was telling Jean, I read it actually over Easter weekend. I read it in 2 days, and it is incredible. I thought, I grew up in Oklahoma as well. I remember the bombing like it was yesterday. I remember the aftermath. The only marathon I've ever run was the Oklahoma City Memorial Marathon. I had a goal to run a marathon before I turned 25. And I said, I can't run a different one. Like, there's no way I can't, you know, travel to Hawaii or do the Las Vegas one. I have to do the run in Oklahoma City for the bombing memorial. And I feel like I've heard, you know, growing up with it, and it's been that long ago, you kind of feel like you've heard every story there was, and I've seen all the media there was to see on it, and every year the anniversary. But this story is incredible between these two men. I'm just dumbfounded. How did you even know there was a story there?
I was so lucky to meet Bud Welch, and through Bud to meet Bill McVeigh, who I didn't expect to love as much as I love this man. And I'll talk more about that later. I met Bud because after my sister Nancy was killed, 6 months went by, and then finally her murderer was caught. But for 6 months, it was a completely cold case. No one could figure out who had killed this happy young couple, shot to death in their own home. And it was particularly cruel because Nancy was 3 months pregnant when she was killed with what would have been their first child, my first little niece or nephew. And when we found out that it was a teenage boy, a 16-year-old who lived only a few blocks away from them, we were shocked, because this town is not a crime-ridden neighborhood. This is a place of great affluence and very few murders. There hadn't been a murder in more than a century. And because Illinois did not have a death penalty for juveniles at the time when he was convicted of the double homicide of the adults and killing the unborn child, the press all wanted to know afterwards, well, aren't you disappointed that he couldn't get the death penalty? And I said, no, that I think that shedding more blood and digging another grave and creating another grieving family like mine would do nothing to heal me. It would only kind of drag me closer to who the killer was, this merciless taker of human life, and away from who Nancy and Richard were, these just good and life-loving people. So through that, I became part of this group of murder victims' family members who believe that the loved ones that we lost are not honored by more killing, that what we're looking for is not revenge and retaliation, but redemption. And doing crime, you know, prevention and violence prevention that would stop another killing like the ones that we suffered in our families. And that's how I met Bud Welch, because he started out hating the bomber, hating Timothy McVeigh. Bud told me in one of our interviews for the book that when Timothy McVeigh was arrested and taken into federal custody and brought out into daylight in this orange jumpsuit with his eyes blinking in the sun, and this crowd had gathered and they were yelling at him, baby killer, murderer, because, you know, 19 small children had been killed in the bombing. And Bud just hoped that a sniper would take him out right there, that it would be a kind of a, like when Lee Harvey Oswald was arrested for assassinating President John F. Kennedy, and a man named Jack Ruby showed up when he was being transported and just shot him dead on the spot. That's what Bud was hoping for. That's how much he hated Timothy McVeigh and wanted him dead. But he started reflecting after about a year on the fact that the death penalty is just retaliation and revenge for a crime. And Timothy McVeigh had committed this horrible act out of retaliation and revenge against the federal government. And so this cycle of hatred and bloodshed, retaliation, revenge, this tit for tat would go on forever. And Bud just decided that it was going to stop with him, that he was going to forgive Timothy McVeigh, reach out to his father, father to father, in compassion and empathy and mercy and grace. And so that's how I got to meet Bud.
This is incredible. Bud was the father of a young woman who was similarly aged to Nancy when she died in the bombing. And she wasn't married yet, but had a boyfriend that was planning, to ask for Bud's daughter's hand in marriage. And when I'm glad that you mentioned the 19 children when you are giving your introduction to Bud, because for the people who may not either be old enough to remember or just haven't learned about this part of our history, at the time it was the most deadly attack of domestic terrorism that we had seen in this country. So this was 1995. This was prior to September 11th, 2001. And part of the building, in part of the building that was blown up by the bomb that Tim McVeigh put in that truck, there was a daycare center for the employees' children of that building. And yeah, like you mentioned, 19 of them passed away, 168 victims total who died in that bombing. And growing up in Oklahoma at that time for months and months and months, I mean, Tim McVeigh was a household name. That was, we knew about him, and we knew about the victims. But I want to maybe take kind of a side and then come back. But when I was reading your other book, it just made me think of it just now when I said Tim McVeigh was a household name. There was a time when, a long time, when you said you couldn't say the name of the man who had murdered your sister and her husband. And can you take us to that place in your heart where you were? Because, you know, we said with Bud, it took a year. He did not immediately feel the desire for forgiveness and reconciliation and mercy at all on this man. And I can't fathom, but you have a similar story. So this took me back to the place in your first book where you talk about not being able to say the name of your sister and her husband's murderer for, I feel like it read like it was quite a long time, but can you take us back to that? Because for Bud, it was not immediate. This wasn't, I feel like when I read Grace from the Rubble, I thought, I don't think that Bud had, I don't feel like he had thought that far ahead, right? It was a kind of a natural reaction for him to feel that, that desire, that hatred almost. I don't want to put words in his mouth, but that.
Oh no, he says I was filled with hate.
Right. But that initial response, it took him a while and it took you a little while too. It wasn't automatic. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So Julie Marie Welch, Bud's only daughter and his youngest child, was murdered at the age of 23 in the Oklahoma City bombing in April 19th, 1995. 5 years earlier to the month, Nancy was murdered in her home, my sister Nancy. And I knew that I did not want the name of her killer to live and for hers to die. How many people can name one of Timothy McVeigh's victims, one of the 168 who died? Or Jeffrey Dahmer or John Wayne Gacy or any of these people that have done these horrific killings, right? We know their names.
Absolutely.
And I thought, I'm going to talk about Nancy, and I'm going to use her name, and I'm going to use the name of her husband, Richard Alexander Langert. But I'm never going to say the name of her killer, because I kind of wanted to bury him alive, to have time forget him.
Wow.
And I went like that for 20 years until I was challenged by a Christian pastor, author, academic named Randall O'Brien to do something I had never once done. And that is to pray for him, to pray for this young man who killed Nancy. Up until that moment, I called him the killer, the murderer, the intruder, the offender. I hadn't called him by his name. And how can you pray for someone whose name you won't say?
Wow.
Instead of making him a non-person. So the first thing I had to do was to say his name, which is David Bureau. David Bureau is the name of the man, young man, who murdered my family members. And what Randall got me to see, because I had asked Randall, you know, what does this even look like? You know,
right.
To reconcile with someone who's not even remorseful. And he said it would look like Jesus on the cross. And when he said that, I started to cry because I knew those words. As our Savior was dying for us, hanging on that cross, he said, Father, forgive them. Forgive them. And that was his prayer to his Heavenly Father for the very people who were not sorry and had not apologized to him and were, surrounding him as he died, daunting him, gambling for his clothes. And that was what led me to first, you know, say the name of the killer. Bud had a kind of a different journey. He was nearly blackout drinking every night after his daughter was murdered. He was smoking 4 packs of cigarettes a day. He was a gas station owner at the time, and so he's pumping gas for his regular customers, and they're seeing what this is doing to him. And they said, Bud, you're killing yourself.
Right.
And he said, the sooner I die, the sooner I'll go to heaven and see my daughter, Julie. I don't care. But then, and he was going every day down to the ruins of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in downtown Oklahoma City, the building that Timothy McVeigh blew up by driving that rented truck up to the, almost the very window of the daycare in the building and setting off the bomb. And he was standing there one day with his just head splitting from the hard nights drinking the night before and just thinking, my customers are right. This is killing me. This is not healing me. And that was what was kind of the beginning of his journey to learning, well, why had Timothy McVeigh done this? He saw that it was only for retaliation and revenge. And he saw that gets you nowhere. It is a cycle. It's an endless cycle, tit for tat, retaliation, revenge, retaliation, revenge. And he said that that's going to stop with me. He decided that he no longer wanted the death penalty for Timothy McVeigh. And he tried to reach out to Tim to speak to him and offer his forgiveness. He was not able to do that. But instead, he reached out to Timothy McVeigh's father, Bill McVeigh.
And offered
this hand of friendship.
This is why I love this story so much and this telling so much, because this is not a political story.
No.
And I say that as someone who grew up in a small town in Oklahoma in the Bible Belt. And for whatever reason, I blame my dad's political science and kind of this justice, you know, core that he has. But this is not what is popular politically. I live in Texas now, for crying out loud, and so this is not what's popular politically. But as a younger adult, I felt like the argument, if you will, against the death penalty or these types of questions could be argued, could be answered in a political way. We could talk about the justice system and the flaws in it, and we could talk about these things. But the reason that I love this story is because it's not about the politics of whether or not someone should die. It's and that cycle, which is one, But you're talking about ending the cycle of even having the heart for retaliation. And I'm reminded of Jesus in the gospel saying, you've heard it say, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but that's not what I'm saying. And when I read these books, both of them, and when I'm reading Grace from the Rubble, I'm saying, this is not a story about politics or the death penalty or the bombing even. This is a story about people taking into their own hearts, internalizing these words of Jesus and saying, you've heard it said, this is going to make things better. But I say it won't. Can you trust me?
Right, right. And Jesus said, love your enemies. And who is the enemy of Bud Welch, if not the person who slaughtered his daughter?
Right.
This young woman with everything to live for, who, as you said, you know, was hoping to marry this Air Force lieutenant that she had been, you know, seriously seeing, who was about to start her dream job as a Spanish teacher. She was working as an interpreter on the first floor of the Murrah building in the Social Security Administration when she died. And she was a daily communicant. She was a deeply faithful Catholic who went to Mass every single day the last 2 years of her life. If you can imagine, at the age of 21, starting this practice of taking communion every single day, to get up an hour early before you get to work by 8 a.m., to go to this 7 a.m. Mass at your Catholic church, to have that communion with Christ. So, you know, who is Bud's enemy if not Timothy McVeigh? And yet he reached out to him and reached out to his father when he was no longer able to try to reach out to Tim, to let him know, I don't hate you. I don't want your, you know, I don't hate you, the father, Tim McVeigh. I don't want your son to die. I'll do everything I can to prevent it. Right. And that was done not out of politics. That was done from love and faith and forgiveness.
That's right. It's so beautiful. And it takes me back to when you had the conversation with Randall, and we're kind of internalizing that and being introspective about not saying David's name, that was creating for you this false reality of him being a non-person instead of being a man made in the image of God. And I think when, you know, to read the story of Bud, and that's, you know, seeing Tim as a person, as a man made in the image of God, and his dad as a hurting father, not as some, you know, man monster who would raise a monster, right? It just seeing him as a father who was already grieving, and who would grieve more. And Bud knew that grief. And right. And to not want that for anyone else is beautiful.
Right, right. And you know what's really important about this story is to see how much Bud understood how Timothy McVeigh came to pull that truck up to the windows of the glass-fronted Murrah Federal Building. It's why he picked the building, not only for the agencies of the federal government that he hated, the ATF, the FBI, and so on, but also because he knew that a glass front would break easier and he would kill more people. He wanted the highest body count possible. And how do you see the humanity of someone like that, who called the people who died there, including those 19 children, collateral damage, which is this callous term that Timothy McVeigh used to describe his victims? Bud was able to do that because he saw that Tim grew up this normal child, never a disciplinary infraction at school, never on the radar screen of the police as a juvenile, babysat for the neighbors, helped out at the church. He went off to join the army around the time that the economy in Western New York — he was living in this small town called Pendleton, New York, outside of Buffalo — and the economy was tanking. There weren't any good jobs to be had. He signed up to join the Army. But in the Army, not only did he experience PTSD in his going over to the Gulf War in Kuwait and Iraq, he also met these two white supremacist, government-hating, gun-loving, misogynist, off-the-grid kind of pro-militia, anti-government guys that were his co-conspirators, Michael Fortier and Terry Nichols. Both of whom were older than him. I think he might have been very impressionable, but he came back infected with that poison from war with the PTSD. And Bud doesn't blame Tim himself. He says that really his daughter Julie was a victim of that war, because if it hadn't happened, Tim McVeigh might not have gone over there, and all of this whole seed that planted in him of this hatred and kind of antipathy towards the government might not have ever taken root.
Right. And it's something that the idea that we get from this book and from your first one as well, the idea that we as people are not only the worst thing that we've ever done. And for Bud to be able to see Tim as a person, I'm taken back to the scene in the book, and I won't spoil it for everyone. It's a fantastic read, but when Bud is sitting at the table with Bill and sees the picture of Tim in high school in the kitchen, you know, in the dining room, just like at any of our homes, you know, that our kids' pictures are up on the wall, and to make the comment that he was a handsome guy, you know, that he was a handsome boy, and to feel, you know, to empathize with Bill, that this was his son. His son was not only his last few years of life when he was infiltrated with that hate. His son was not only the man who conspired to build that bomb and pull the truck up. He did those things, and that was part of his life, but that was not his whole life. You know, he was all of those things that you said. You know, Bill watched him take his first steps and learn how to ride a bike. And there's grief in that for any parent who would lose that innocence of their own child, whether they're 20 when something like that would happen, or if they were 50, it doesn't matter. And so I just love that part of the story, that Bud could somehow see that, and that Bill would feel seen and known and valued by that.
Yes. Yeah. One of the most heartbreaking things I learned when I was interviewing Bill McVeigh for this book was that at the death penalty portion of Timothy's trial, and this was held in Colorado because, of course, you know, as an Oklahoman,
right,
that there was no way that this person was going to get a fair trial in the state of Oklahoma. People were just too emotionally stunned and hurt by what had happened. And so the trial was moved to Denver, Colorado. And Bill McVeigh is an excruciatingly shy and private person. And the thought of taking the stand for him and having to beg for his son's life was really difficult. And the defense team could see that. So the lawyers for the defense said instead, why don't we make a video? We'll have you standing in front of the school that Tim went to when he was little, or the house that he grew up in, and you can kind of narrate it, which was really a good idea because it kind of helped Bill not feel so self-conscious about what he is saying as he's speaking. So some of the scenes that they showed were Timothy McVeigh as a little boy in his pajamas at Christmas.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
As a little kid growing up, riding in the back of his dad's tractor, because they had this very large backyard in this rural area where they lived, with this enormous garden where Bill would grow rows of corn and beans and squash, potatoes, lettuce, things like that. So riding on a tractor or swimming in this above ground backyard pool that they had in their house. And you see these scenes of this person who is still the nation's worst domestic mass murderer. you mentioned that September 11th happened, you know, after that bombing. That's the worst act of foreign terrorism on U.S. soil.
Right.
But what Timothy McVeigh did is still the worst act of domestic terrorism at 168 dead. And I didn't even know this until I started researching the book. The other place in history it has, that was the deadliest strike on U.S. soil since Pearl Harbor. Wow. So Pearl Harbor happened in 1941. This happened in 1995. So more than half a century went by before you have that much loss of life on American soil.
Wow. It's just, it was unfathomable to me. The book took me back. The book took me back to that place. Gina and I were talking a little bit before we recorded, and I grew up in Southern Oklahoma. My aunt worked in Oklahoma City at the time. And I said, I don't know if they would do it now, but when the bombing happened, well, I think at first we didn't really know. It was local news for us, and the helicopters were going, and there were reporters there. It was, you know, was it a natural gas explosion? Was this something that was accidental? Which building was it? And I was in middle school, probably like a keyboarding class or something. I just remember us all being in front of these word processing screens, and they had a TV in each classroom. And in my middle school, they put the live news on, and it happened at around 9 o'clock in the morning. And we were all in school, and they put it on the news for us to see. And so this was one of those things that, of course, I had heard the generation before me. Everyone knew where they were when they heard the news that Kennedy was shot. And then all of us now listening, most of us know, you know, we can recall where we were when the trade centers were attacked. But for Oklahomans, and I feel like nationally, this was something where we knew where we were when we learned of the bombing of the Murrow Building in Oklahoma City. And reading this book took me back there in a lot of ways. It was kind of more emotional than I thought it was going to be, for those reasons, as well as for the relationship between Bud and Bill. So thank you for that, because you just did a spectacular job of capturing, I feel like, the essence of where this happened. You know, this, so I don't even know. I feel like maybe we can go there. I feel like there's a bit of a juxtaposition, and I didn't know if we were going to talk about it, but let's just throw this out. But I feel like there's a bit of a juxtaposition, because in the book you write what I remember, which is there was essentially no crime after this happened. There was no looting, and I'll let you talk about that in just a moment, but this is just the kind of place that Oklahoma City is. I think that feels exaggerated for a lot of people, probably. They can't imagine that it feels too Andy Griffith. It kind of feels fake. But that's just the kind of place that Oklahoma is. It's just the kind of place that Oklahoma City is. And then at the same time that I'm recalling that, in a very fond way, I feel like I was struck later in the book when you talk about there being the opportunity, the fund created for there to be the opportunity, not just for the victims' families to sit in on the trial, because I think that's very understandable, but opportunity for there to be victims' families to witness Tim's execution. Am I remembering this correctly?
You are.
Can you talk about that? I mean, maybe talk about both of those things. And then I just see this kind of, how can these two things both exist with the same group of people in the same time and space? It feels very, like I said, it just feels like a juxtaposition to me.
That's such a great question. No one's ever asked me that, and I love that you did. So let's start with the crime and the lack of looting and just the unity of Oklahoma City. So Oklahoma City, for those who are not like you and I, people who grew up in,
right,
in this heartland, modest city,
right, yes.
You know, it was settled by pioneers of people who grew up on farms and they were used to calamities coming at them from the sky, right? You had the Dust Bowl in the 30s that just ravaged the land and destroyed the crops and forced all these, you know, starving Okies, as they were called, out to places like California. It was captured in John Steinbeck's novel, The Grapes of Wrath. These refugees from this land that had just been ravaged. Tornadoes, hail, yes, thunderstorms, right? Lightning that would strike someone's barn and it would burn down. And the neighbors would pitch in to help you rebuild it. That's just this prairie settler tradition that, you know, we grew up with, right?
Right.
So when the bombing struck, one of the things that happened was that people who were doctors and nurses immediately just flocked to the site because they knew they would be needed. One of the 168 victims is a nurse in her 40s. She was a mother and a wife, and she was killed trying to help people there when debris struck, fell, and struck her on the head. All of her organs ended up being donated to, you know, other people who needed them. I mean, that was her sacrifice. So when the bomb went off, one of the things that was destroyed was the third floor Federal Employees Credit Union with a vault full of cash, and thousands of dollars blew into the street. All of the money was returned in an amount greater than the amount that was lost.
It's incredible.
Floating down in the streets and people sweeping it up and giving it back. All the windows of the downtown banks were shattered. Windows were shattered as far as 30 miles away in Guthrie, Oklahoma. And so all these cash drawers were standing there empty and they were completely untouched.
Right.
One of the things that I loved learning about was this thing called the Oklahoma dollar, where when anybody who had come in from anywhere to help, whether it was a team of firefighters from out of state or a team of doctors or, you know, all the people who came to help, if they stayed in a hotel and checked out, there was no bill. If they ate at a restaurant, no one would take their money. When there was no check that ever came, people asked for a check and they said, there isn't one. People in Oklahoma City were so very grateful for anyone to help them. I love what you said about when you're a child that you thought, wow, natural gas explosions. Some people thought maybe it'd been a plane that had some engine failure on the way to Will Rogers Airport and it crashed. One of the people I loved interviewing for the book was the governor of Oklahoma at the time,
Frank Keating. Yeah.
Who was just a few months on the job as governor. Mm-hmm. There had been the mayor's prayer breakfast that morning. He had just gone back to his governor's office after the prayer breakfast when he said, there's this bulletproof glass in his office, and the window kind of went, this motion from this loud sound that they heard. His staff immediately thought it was a natural gas explosion, but he had spent his whole career in the FBI before that, and he knew that's not what it was. Right. Once he saw the destruction, he thought that was a deliberate destruction.
Wow.
And within minutes, then President Bill Clinton was on the phone with him saying, what happened and how can I help?
Right.
So juxtapose that 2 years later, 6 years later after this happened, when Timothy McVeigh had withdrawn his appeals once he got the death penalty, he did not want to spend the rest of his life in prison. Right. He wanted to die.
Right.
That was the outcome he wished for. He said that very explicitly to a journalist. I think it was Ed Bradley from 60 Minutes in the interview, where Timothy McVeigh just said to him, the death penalty, it's really an oxymoron. He said, death isn't a penalty. It's an escape. He said, you think, you know, the federal government thinks they've got me. I'm this trophy they won. He said, they haven't won. With the crudest terms, 168-1. And we know what that means, right?
Right.
He killed 168 people, including those 19 children in the building. And we're going to kill this one person, him. So if it's supposed to be an eye for an eye, by our own math, he wins.
Right.
But we will never be even, right? So the people who were family members of the survivors of the victims who died were given the opportunity to either witness it in person, to the extent that there was room. I think they had a total of 10 people that were allowed to witness it live, where it was carried out in Terre Haute, Indiana. And the rest were given the opportunity to watch it on closed circuit TV at another location. Far fewer people asked to do that than they thought But I remember that day really well, and some of those family members coming out and being asked, do you feel better now that he's been executed? And they all said no.
Right.
They all said the same thing. One, that he hadn't suffered enough. And two, that he had never said he was sorry before he died. And that just broke my heart, because as a family member of a murder victim who had that opportunity to reconcile and hear that apology from the killer years later, well, that was 23 years after my sister was murdered. If we had taken the life of David Biro, the person who murdered my family members, I might never have heard that confession and that apology, that heartfelt expression of remorse that has been so healing to me and so helpful. I think the mistake we made is that we killed Timothy McVeigh before he had a chance to be sorry.
Right. Right.
For God to change his heart, because I really do believe that God created each one of us, including David Biro, including Timothy McVeigh, and that God has the power to change anyone's heart, that no one's irredeemable. And I look at characters from the Bible as evidence of that. Moses was a murderer. David, king, you know, the one who wrote the Psalms, you know, many of the Psalms, he was a murderer. You know, the worst kind of murder there is, in my opinion, a murderer who didn't have the guts to carry it out himself, but had someone else do it for him. Saul, the person that we call Paul after that road to Damascus conversion, he assisted in making sure that Christian men, women, and children were killed.
Right.
And God used them all. God redeemed them. So from my perspective as a Christian, I think that no human being is beyond that forgiveness and mercy that I write about in this book.
Oh, it's so true. It's so true. And that's why I mentioned this is not a political story. This is a story of forgiveness and mercy and really, really believing in the depths of our hearts what we say to be true about Jesus. Because all of us are a murderer. All of us are an adulterer. All of us are a sinner. And all of us are more than the worst things we've ever done. And all of us have had and are having the opportunity over and over to seek forgiveness and to ask for that. And even I feel like even in the New Testament, when it says, this is why God is tarrying, because he's so patient. He wants everybody to have the opportunity to come to know him. And you say, when we take this matter into our own hands, we're taking that patience away. We're taking that opportunity away. Not just for the healing and reconciliation found with the victims' families and with victims themselves of different types of crimes. But obviously implicit in that is we're taking away the opportunity for that person to have that change of heart for himself or herself and to have that experience of remorse and then the redemption that follows that. And I think those of us who believe can remember back when we say, I wouldn't trade that experience for anything in my life. The moment that I realized I'm forgiven, I'm redeemed, God's not finished with me yet. And when we could feel his love and his compassion poured out on us, we wouldn't trade that for anything. And we wouldn't want to take that away from anyone else. We wouldn't want to take that opportunity from anyone else.
That is so beautiful. I love that. And as you were speaking, it made me think of one of our most beloved hymns, Amazing Grace.
Yes.
How sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost. Now I'm found. I was blind, but now right. I see.
Right. Yeah. It's so good. I want to, as we kind of start to near wrapping up, I want to talk about this love and hate, because in your first book, you talk about hate and how you maybe, I'll don't want to put words in your mouth, but maybe I'll say, if you didn't know anything else at the time, you knew that's not what you wanted, was hate for your own life. And in this Grace from the Rubble, you talk about how love is just so much more powerful. So can you tell us about, I want to be sensitive because I can't imagine even decades later how difficult it still is, but in those moments when you uttered those words about hate after Nancy's death, and then take us to why love and God's love and his forgiveness is so much stronger than that.
So when Nancy was, when her body was discovered, it was Palm Sunday. My dad went over to their house after church and found them dead, shot to death in the basement. I, at the time, was at my church. I sing in the choir. I still do. And it was Palm Sunday. I'm standing in my choir robe in the back of my church. And the church secretary comes to me and puts her hand on my arm and says, there's a phone call for you. And I said, well, gee, you know, I'm about to sing. Like, can you take a message? And she said, no, you need to come with me. So I went to her office kind of shaking because I knew something was terribly wrong. It was my father on the phone telling me that Nancy and Richard had been killed. And that the pastor of his church was coming to pick me up. So I sat there in the church office crying for 45 minutes till the pastor came and drove me to the Winnetka police station, this little town where Nancy and Richard were shot to death. And when the police told us that they had in fact been shot, because at that point we didn't even know what the cause of death was. They were just covered in blood. They didn't know exactly how they had lost their lives. When I found out that someone had actually pointed a gun at my beautiful sister, looked into her shining eyes, this beautiful young woman, and pulled a trigger and ended her life, the very first thing out of my mouth was this: I don't want to hate anyone. And everybody looked at me like I was crazy, right? But I think it was because up until that moment, I lived this pretty privileged and happy, safe and sheltered life. Nothing too much terrible had ever happened to me. And this was so terrible, so evil, killing a pregnant woman and her husband that were on the verge of having all their dreams come true, you know, moving into their own home, having their first child. They were so in love and so happy, and to have that all cut short in such a deliberate and cruel way seemed so awful to me. And I thought, how much hate would be enough to pay for the life of my sister and her child and her husband? If I start hating whoever did this, I will drift off into this endless ocean of hate. There will not be enough hate in the universe to pay for this, right? It has to be bigger. And there's only one thing bigger than hate, and that's love. So bring us now to the story of Bud and Bill. Bud learned firsthand what hating does to a human being. There's this saying I write about in my first book, that hating another person is like drinking poison and expecting the other person to die. Right. Someone said to me once that bitterness consumes the vessel that contains it, meaning I can harbor hate against this other person, and that other person isn't going to notice or care at all. They may not even know that I'm waking up every morning hating him or her, right, and thinking about them and wishing evil would befall them, right? It's only hurting me. And God wants to free us from that. God wants to roll that stone off our hearts, wants to free us from that burden. That's when we can truly live. That's when things can truly grow in us and we can bear fruit and live the kind of abundant life that God wants for us. We can't have that if we're carrying around this burden of hate and bitterness towards another human being.
I love the grace of God that I see in that story, because I just feel like it's almost like you had to say it out loud. And then I don't even know the way your story reads. It's like did you even know what you were saying when you were saying it? You know?
No, I did not. It just came out.
It just came out, but it's just the grace of God in that, that you would have that memory for the rest of your life of this is the first thing that came out of your mouth when you learned of this is, I don't want to hate anyone. And I just see God's grace in that. And I'm so thankful because I think that you're exactly right. When we're kind of left to our own devices, man, it can be a downward spiral really fast.
Yeah.
Really fast.
Yeah. And, you know, I was so lucky because I went in the first week after Nancy was killed to the pastor of my church because I kept playing this kind of horror movie in my head on a continuous loop that she walks through the front door of her house. She sees this shadowy figure in the dark. She sees this gun pointed at her and her husband. They're taken to the basement. The shot goes off. She sees her husband fall to the floor. She feels the bullets, you know, burn through her body. You know, all of that was so dark. I wasn't eating. I wasn't sleeping. I was just having nightmares. And I went to the pastor of my church and said, help me.
Right.
What do I do? And he makes these two clenched fists in front of his face. And he said, you're holding on to it like this. And it's too much for you. You can't bear up under this. You have to loosen your grip, open up your palms, lift them skyward, lift them up to God and say, take this. It is too much for me. Redeem it. Do something with this. Right. And I can look back over the decades now that have passed since then and see so powerfully how that promise was abundantly fulfilled in everything that has happened since then, of the many ways that God used Nancy's story to help people understand about forgiveness, about mercy, about God's grace towards us, all that we have to be, to atone for, to be forgiven for.
Right.
And so I think that that's partly why I chose the title I did for the book about Bud and Bill and this whole tragedy of Oklahoma City is that, yes, there was rubble. Yes, there was horrendous tragedy. But there's also grace that emerged from that. And that's the same for you and for me and everyone listening. All of us have had some kind of wound that we've suffered from someone else. All of us have inflicted a wound on someone else. And there is this grace. There is this way out of this hurt that we have inflicted and that we've experienced. And it's a way into healing and hope.
You just wrapped it up and said exactly what I hoped you would say, because there are people who will listen to this, who could have had a family member or a friend die in that very act in 1995. There were victims who were injured, and, we may have people listening who knew someone who died in the terror attacks in New York City, but also it's exactly as you said, we've all been sinned against and we've all sinned against people. And there is grace that can come from that rubble. I just love it. It's just beautiful. So I just want to encourage everybody, get your hands on a copy of this book. I mean, Amazon may not be shipping right now. We're in the middle of COVID crisis, but buy it on Kindle. Buy the other one on Kindle. I highlighted. My Kindle is lit up with these two stories because there were just so many truths that I wanted to look back on even later and reflect on and let them sink deep into me, because this is the essence. So much of this is the essence of who God is. It's compassion and love and forgiveness and mercy for people who, quote, don't deserve it, just like us.
Right.
So
right.
Jean, how can people see more of this book? How can we see more of what you've done or what you're doing now? Do you have social media channels or website or anything that we can connect to?
Yes, the website is jeanbishop.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Jean Bishop, and or friend me on Facebook. And I'm so, so grateful for this amazing discussion. Thank you so very much.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate you coming on. We'll talk soon.
Bye.
Bye. So thank you again so much for listening. Don't forget to subscribe so you won't miss an episode. Share the link with your friends. You can visit us at thatmakestotalsense.com. And until next time, this is Alexis Busetti, remembering to do well for ourselves so we can do good for others. Bye.